Call the Board of Regents meeting into session. I will first have an invocation from Mr. Tripp Carpenter. Mr. Carpenter is chair of the WKU Spirit Masters, and he's a senior in Owensboro, majoring in history and film studies. And he studied abroad at Harlaxton and is a member of Phi Gamma Delta fraternity.
Please bow your heads. We pray that this meeting is blessed and the proceedings will result in the best outcomes. For this, our homecoming weekend, we ask for many blessings. Please be with the students, alumni, and family of both as they travel to and from campus to visit their WKU family. In the spirit of homecoming, I pray that our passion to serve WKU never dies. Please keep the interest of WKU close to our hearts so the spirit of this university continues to grow. Amen.
All right. Next, we'll have the oath of office for Mr. Gillard Johnson. And President Ransel is going to assist.
She was going to raise her hand. I probably wanted her in there better.
One of the things we do as a Board of Regents at Community Division University is each region gets a regent. The only members who have served on this Board of Regents, and we hope to be aware of that proudly. It is modeled after the WKU senior rank. So that's something that you will say during the Board of Regents.
Philip Bale.
Present.
Ms. Kiana Boca. Ms. Cynthia Harris.
Here.
Mr. Freddie Higdon.
Here.
Mr. Gil Johnson.
Here.
Mr. James Kennedy.
Here.
Dr. Patricia Minter.
Here.
Mr. David Porter.
Here.
Mr. John Ridley.
Here.
Mr. Larry Zelke.
Thank you. Now, consider an approval of the minutes that were distributed prior to the meeting. These are the minutes of the special budget approval meeting of June 21st, 2013, and the third quarterly meeting on July 26th. Is there a motion to approve?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All in favor, aye.
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 Any opposition? Passes unanimously.
June meeting? Chair, June meeting as well? For the minutes of the June meeting?
The June 21st minutes. Has everyone reviewed the copy of the June 21st minutes that were distributed prior to the meeting? Do I hear a motion for approval?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Looks like it was unanimous.
Before we get into our academic affairs committee agenda, I'm going to circle it around two things, and it kind of illustrates the ends of the spectrum that we deal with as a university community on a daily basis. One is a letter that came from a student studying in France at St. Etienne University, where we have a partnership agreement with our Gordon Ford College of Business. And it's just a very inspiring letter about her struggles to find a way to be able to do that study abroad experience, and her major is international business and French. And I thought you'd be inspired by reading her letter that just came in 2 days ago. And the other is article that ran this week about Anna Zykova. Anna Zykova was an engineering graduate, graduated last spring, magna cum laude, incredible student, pole vaulter on our track team, All Sunbelt Conference pole vaulter, and was the favorite among students in our Department of Engineering. She graduated in May, went to the University of Kentucky for graduate school, was diagnosed with cancer this summer, and died last week. She's from Russia. Her proudest moment was carrying her nation's flag in our commencement ceremony. And we, our faculty in engineering, put up a plaque for her at the little cubby where she studied in the engineering building throughout her undergraduate experience, and really a favorite among our students. So it's been a tough few days for our engineering students, so I thought I'd circulate these around and let you all see those. So a lot happens in the life of a complex university, and some are tragic and some are filled with elation, and it's covered both ends of that spectrum.
I'll make a comment about the consent agenda. Of course, we had committee meetings on September 27th and discussed each item on each of those agendas. There are three additional items that appear on today's agenda, items 1.6, 2.6, and 3.4. These three items that have been added are exempt from the consent agenda and will be discussed and voted on separately. So we will proceed with the reports of the committees and call on Dr. Bale, Chair of the Academic Affairs Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the Academic Committee does have several important items for our approval today, most of which will fall under the consensus motion, I believe. We do have one item, 1.5, that Dr. Minter would like to have out of the consensus agenda so that she can make some comments about one of her colleagues. And before we ask for a motion on 1.1, 1.2, 1.3, and 1.4, I'll ask if our provost would like to say anything about any of those items.
1.1 through 1.4 include the
approval of the Arabic undergraduate major minor and the Chinese undergraduate major minor. Representatives, Dean David Lee, Assistant Dean Andrew McMichael, Department Head Laura McGee, and Professors David DeMeo and Kay Peng are present. And the other two items refer to administrative name changes and creation of departments, one in marketing, one in psychological sciences, as we discussed at the committee meeting.
Okay. Are there any items among those four that any other committee members would like to exclude? Also, let me, for sake of the audience, let me identify who is on the committee. Dr. Minter and Dr. Dennison to my left, Boca to my right, and our newly minted Regent Gill are all part of the academic committee, and I'm pleased as chairman to have every one of their involvement. And with that, I will ask for a motion for consensus agreement on items 1.1 through 1.4.
So moved.
Second.
Have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Not. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, like sign. Motion passes. And with that, we will consider item 1.5, and I will ask Dr. Minter to make some comments.
Delighted to do so. It is a great honor to have the opportunity to talk about our colleagues who will this morning be voted on for emeritus or emeritus status. And I'm delighted that there are two of our proposed emeriti faculty with us this morning, Dr. Jan Garrett from the Department of Philosophy and Religion, and Mr. Russell Moore from the Department of English. If you don't mind, if you want to stand up while I say a few nice things about you. Dr. Garrett came to WKU as a faculty member in the philosophy department in 1984 and taught full-time until he began the transitional retirement program in 2008. And Dr. Garrett taught a variety of courses over the years, but was particularly interested in ethics. And when I first met Jan Garrett, it was actually when he was teaching ethics almost exclusively. And we met on a panel where we were two of three panelists talking about the anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And I seriously doubt that he remembers that, but I remember that vividly and thinking how wonderful it was to have such a learned colleague and mentor in the field of human rights. He has devoted a good deal of his time to mentoring students, especially those who were developing research and community-based social justice projects. And he still maintains a faculty website that invites students to join him in discussions about philosophy and social justice. So whether he's on the bus, at the march, or just showing up for social justice, Dr. Jan Garrett has shown how a life of the mind can also translate into a life of free pursuit of justice, and we thank you for your service. Mr. Russell Moore came to WKU in 1969. He taught English full-time for nearly 40 years, also entering transitional retirement in 2008. And during his long career, Mr. Moore taught English literally to thousands of WKU students and was especially effective in business writing courses and in first-year composition course, which is the lifeblood of that department. A letter from an attorney who had Russell as a teacher at Breckenridge County High School, as well as at WKU, said that he was, quote, the single most important educator in my life, and his influence as an educator continues to benefit me to the present day. I think there's no higher praise for what it is that we all try to do every day than that, and we thank you very much for your service. Other colleagues who could not be with us this morning, but whose meritorious service certainly deserves some mention. Dr. Alan Anderson is receiving emeritus status from the Department of Philosophy and Religion, and he came here in 1985 as head of that department, which he a position he held until 1999. Dr. Anderson was both a participant in and a student of the civil rights movement. And he first met Dr. Martin Luther King in jail in 1962 when, after King visited him, when he was spending a week in South Georgia jail protesting the segregation in Albany, Georgia. And he subsequently played a major role in 1966 in the movement in Chicago, where he was literally the point person for Dr. King's Fair Housing campaign that took place in that year. And at the same time, he was pursuing studies in social ethics at the University of Chicago. And it is a result of that work that he received his degree in ethics and co-authored a Pulitzer Prize-nominated book on the Chicago phase of the movement, Confronting the Color Line, which is one of the 20 books that I keep handy and use it almost every week of my scholarly life. It, I should also say that he was by far the most popular visitor I ever had to my courses on the civil rights movement. So we thank him for his service and sorry he can't join us. Dr. Vernon Shealy will receive emeritus status from Counseling and Student Affairs, and he served WKU from 1968 until 2013. Dr. Shealy's career was marked by extraordinary service to the department, to his college, and to the university. His 45 years of service was recognized by Governor Beshear in the appointment of Dr. Shealy as a Kentucky colonel. He received, over time, the College of Education and Behavioral Sciences Faculty Award of Excellence for teaching, for public service, for research and creativity, and student advisement. That's a grand slam, folks. And his service also included mentoring numerous counselors throughout the Commonwealth. From the Ogden College of Science and Engineering, we have two proposed emeriti. Dr. Nicholas Crawford was a world-renowned karst expert and was recognized as University Distinguished Professor in 2006. The recipient of 1985 Outstanding Achievement in Research Award and 1996 Public Service Award. And he founded the Center for Cave and Karst Studies and inaugurated the long-running and extremely important Cave and Karst Summer Field Studies program at Mammoth Cave. And finally, Dr. Michael Trapasso, also a professor in geography and geology, taught at WKU from 1980 until 2013. He doesn't have a time machine. But it'd be cool if he did. He built the meteorological science program at WKU and curated the College Heights Weather Instrumentation Museum. I knew him best as an expert on the Civil War and its impacts on Bowling Green and Warren County. And from hearing him on the radio, he was everywhere as a climate expert and talking about other geographical topics. For 30 years, he served as a climate consultant and was the winner of the Ogden College Faculty Excellence Award in 1986. And it is an honor to move my colleagues for approval as emeriti professors.
Do I hear a second?
Second.
I have a motion and a second for approval of the emeriti positions as so eloquently described to us by Dr. Minter. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, like sign. Motion passes unanimously. And if I may add, it is wonderful to have you two show up. And I'm sure the others would like to have been here, but for us to put faces to names is a real treat and certainly helps us keep in perspective what we are here to do. So thank both of you all for being here. With that, we will move to a new item, which is 1.6, and this was not on our committee agenda. So, Mr. Provost, would you like to tell us about the honorary doctorate degree?
I'd be glad to bring for your consideration the request to present a Doctor of Business Leadership honorary degree to Mr. Zahir Safia. Mr. Safia earned degrees in economics and business administration from WKU in 1969 and was inducted into the WKU Hall of Distinguished Alumni in 1998. As well as establishing a variety of scholarships to encourage international students to enroll and complete their degrees at WKU, Mr. Safia also established the Safia Downing International Center. It's the house on the street with the flags in front of it. Consistent with WKU's mission to be a leading American university, international reach. Ms. Sophia has steadily encouraged international students to enroll here, and we're pleased to recommend them for a Doctor of Business Leadership degree in that regard. Their intention is to invite Ms. Sophia to be present during our Reach Week. That's in March, where he can interact with students, give seminars and so forth, and to recognize him with a Doctor of Business Leadership degree during that period.
All right. Thank you very much. Another example of Western alumnus giving back.
Mentioned another item or two about Zhu here. He chaired the Ohio State University Board of Trustees for several years while he was chairman of Huntington Bank in Columbus, Ohio. As he moved to Florida, to Sarasota, with his wife Susan, started a bank in Florida, which just a few weeks ago was recognized as the, Catherine, I may not get my terminology exactly right, but the leading, most successful new bank in the state of Florida, and he started that bank probably at the worst possible time during the recession, but persevered, and with his business acumen, brought it to a level of being recognized as the most successful bank in Florida. So he's quite the entrepreneur and quite the role model for our students. Catherine?
I wanted to say, in addition, I've been in this country without knowledge of English and had left a very bad situation in his home country. He found here a home and people who helped him, faculty who reached out to him. So he is in every way an example of a person from another country who came here really in a very sad situation and is becoming a huge success. And he credits the university with having made that possible and has been not only a generous supporter, but has been very interested in international students and others in the same situation. So his success is magnificent, but when you think where he started and what the university meant to him, I think it's even more meaningful.
And had Randy Capps as a mentor.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Strong case for immigration, it sounds like to me.
Yeah.
Well, I'll entertain a motion for conferring of an honorary doctorate degree for Dr. Sophia. Soon to be doctor.
So moved.
Second.
Motion and a second. Any discussion? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, like sign. Motion passes unanimously. For the last items for the academic committee meeting are a couple of informational items. I think we have been given some prior information on this. I know the military student services was something I was not aware of, that Western has carved out quite a niche for itself in that arena, and I think we have a special treat maybe coming with them today. So, Mr. Provost, would you like to?
I'm pleased to present what I dare say may be a unique informational item for you. And I look at the Guthrie Tower out the window here, and it's particularly relevant with that and say that WKU is very pleased to be an extraordinarily military-friendly campus in a large variety of ways. And we have two presenters today, Dean Dennis George of the University College, who's also our Associate Provost for Regional Higher Education, and Ms. Tanya Archie of our Military Student Services Unit, and I'll hand it over to them. Dennis.
Thanks, Provost Tinsley, Distinguished Board, President Ransdale. I just want to say what an honor it is for University College and for me personally to provide an administrative home for Military Student Services. Probably the smartest thing that I've done for me is to hire Tanya Archie to be Director of Military Student Services. And even smarter yet, all I've done since then is just simply stay out of her way and let her take off. And a veteran herself, she has done a fabulous job of building that unit. And I'm just going to turn this is her presentation, and turn it over to her to tell you the great things that she's doing.
Well, thank you very much, and I want to thank you all for allowing us to be here, because I think that this is a little, it's a secret. It's been a little nicely kept secret, but we want to just let everybody know what we're doing. And we have a lot of students, and I think that's going to really surprise you all. So thank you for having us this morning. I was initially hired to run the Wormia Educational Portal, and that's a great responsibility. I equate it to running our Blackboard portal here at the university.
However, they're intuitive, and the soldiers need a lot of help. And we're getting more and more soldiers into the portal every day. Right now, as of this week, we have 353 soldiers in the portal. And they do require a lot of assistance. So one of the things that we created in Military Student Services to help all of our military students, and let me point out here that we do serve the entire military community at Western Kentucky University. We have a lot of smaller units like our ROTC units, but we actually serve all of those students as well from our office. So we created a Veterans Resource Center in order to help the total student body of our Military Student Services. What we consider our military students are our active duty, our reservists, our National Guard, and their family members. One of our most popular programs in the Veterans Resource Center is our Textbooks for Troops program, and we created that right here on Western's campus. When I would go out and speak to 200 or 300 soldiers at a time in our National Guard units, the sad thing that I was finding out is that a lot of our National Guard guys are unemployed. And the Army will pay their tuition to come to Western, but if they are not working, how are they going to afford their books? So this is a program that has put us on the map in the nation as a Best for Vets college. So our Textbooks for Troops program was created right here on Western's campus, and I see it as an admission and retention tool because it attracts students who might not otherwise be able to afford to come to college. This is like a scholarship, but it's better because I call it the ultimate recycling program. We take textbooks, we loan them out to our military students, they bring them back to us. So those same books go on semester after semester helping our soldiers, and we are sending these books all over the world. We just sent books off this week to Afghanistan. Right now we have over 1,000 books in our library, and this is the largest textbook scholarship of this type in the state of Kentucky. We also have a therapy dog who's brand new. He's only been here for 2 weeks. I'm going to bring him in at the end, so I'm going to kind of quickly go through these slides so you all have time to see our therapy dog because he's pretty special. But these are just some of the things that we're doing in military student services, and this is certainly not all. I wouldn't even be able to touch all of the things that we're doing today. Who are we serving? When I first started, we really didn't know. And I started pulling stats and started talking to our VA certifying officials over in Potter Hall, our financial aid area, and we came up with some numbers, and surprisingly enough, we had about 242 before I started. This semester, we have 1,737 students, and that is not all of them, okay? There are several veterans of my age that are out of GI Bill benefits, and we might just be floating around because we're not identified, we're not using our GI Bill benefits. And those students using GI Bill benefits, we have 667 this semester that were served by our VA certifying officials. There was a misconception at the university that we were losing money with our military students, because if you have 109 war orphans, their tuition is completely paid by the university. That's a state mandate. Every public university has to, if they're a war orphan, they have to waive the tuition. But with the number of military students that we have, a conservative estimate of the tuition revenue that these students are bringing into the university is about $15 million a year. That's likely higher because we really don't know our true number. I'm guessing that we have more like 2,000 military students on our campuses today. This last spring, we had 120 military and veterans graduate from Western. Now, the family members, the total was probably a little higher than that for the family members. But just for our active duty and our veterans, we had 120 graduate. I just wanted to point out a couple of other things that the university as a whole offers that makes us military friendly. We have the only Veterans Upward Bound program in the state of Kentucky. That is a pre-college program. That's a pre-college program, meaning that they don't have to come to Western. They go through Veterans Upward Bound, but they don't actually have to choose Western. 90% of their students do choose Western as their college, but they could be going to Harvard or Yale or anywhere around the country. but we have the only Veterans Upward Bound program. We also have the only acquired brain injury resource program in the state of Kentucky, along with our Veterans Resource Center, our textbooks for troops, and of course you all know that we have an award-winning Army ROTC program, but did you all know that we have an Air Force ROTC program on campus? Very few people know that, and our office, we partner with all these areas around campus so that we can promote each other. We're a team, we work as a team, and our office is not the only one that's working to bring those 2,000 students into the campus. We're all working together on that. Of course, we had a long-standing relationship with Fort Knox, and beginning in November, I'm going to start going to the newcomers at Fort Campbell. So we're going to have our footprint at Fort Campbell, which is what we've been wanting to do for a long time. That's really kind of out of our territory. I'm just kind of sneaking in. So...
off the record.
Yeah, so where we go from here is that we're going to keep the momentum going. We want to get out there and do more face-to-face contact with our soldiers. We have 57 National Guard units around the state of Kentucky, and I want to be in front of every one of those soldiers. So that's my goal. Unfortunately, with the obligations that we have with going on the yet, it's kind of hard for me to get out of the office. We've got so many students that we're serving right here on the main campus. That's very hard for us to get out of the office, but we're doing our best. So, do you all have any questions for me? And I just want you to know that all of these students that you all saw on this line, they are all our students. So, if I don't have any questions, I'm going to get our special guest.
Oh, you have a question?
I have a question.
Oh,
would you clarify the two? I thought you said 2,000 students that are associated with the military in some fashion. Did I understand you say that?
That's probably an accurate number. We know from our stats that we pulled this semester that we have 1,737.
And that represents 10% of our student population approximately?
Close.
And folks, we have the largest population of military students in the state of Kentucky.
That brings up, I applaud your team concept for bringing all the departments together. That cohesion is very important to this university, and I applaud you for that. Just as a point of reference, too, you were kind enough to mention an unfunded mandate of veterans' children, the orphans of veterans. I would ask our board to recognize that word unfunded mandate, not from a standpoint that our interest in helping these people should be foremost, but it is our responsibility to go to our legislators as we approach this and recognize that we are picking up these costs, as we should. Mm-hmm. However, that is a burden financially. As chairman of the Finance Committee, that's a burden. And we should go to our legislators and say, if these things are important to the state, then the state of Kentucky should fund these unfunded mandates. Not just put the burden on the only source, and that is, of course, our university. We need to work harder at legislating against these unfunded mandates. That penalizes those that are trying hard to get an education, and unfunded mandates should be totally funded.
There are several of those, John.
Yes, exactly they are.
Right. It comes to several million dollars we spend each year on legislatively mandated populations that the state says they come tuition free, yet the state provides no money to support that. And if we were to get that funded, it would be, and I'm thinking about a $3 to $4 million increase to our budget if the state simply funded what it forces upon us to fund in the form of...
And I want to be perfectly clear, this is not what our social responsibility is. This is, if the legislators put this upon us to do, then we either have to take away from providing textbooks or something to dilute our ability to educate the whole for a selected group. And I truly believe that the legislators should do a much better job of understanding what that is when they say the word unfunded mandate. That's a key thing to us. So I applaud you for all that you're doing, and this is a serious effort that we should continue. Thank you.
It may be that a resolution from this board at some point could be helpful.
I think that the other universities in the state can have to agree with you all, because it's something that... they're all struggling with. And I would say that they probably have about the same number that we do of our war orphans.
Tanya, our campus in Elizabethtown, about 1,200 students, Dennis. What's the, of our military enrollments, what's the ratio at our campus in at Elizabethtown, Fort Knox, where we're actually have programs on post at Fort Knox. Our Elizabethtown enrollment has to be a much higher percentage of military affiliated personnel.
Well, that's what you would think, but I think it's about. The answer to that is I really don't know, but I think it's about 50-50 because we have a huge population of veterans in this area. Most of my National Guard guys are right here on campus. They're coming over from the VRC and getting help with the Army Ed. And we have 21,000 veterans in this local area alone. So, you know, we have a large population here. And it's surprising to them, too. And let me just tell you that our Fort Knox office is very busy. That they have walk-ins coming constantly. So I would assume that it's about 50-50.
We actually have a classroom and an office on post at Fort Knox, which serves active duty military exceedingly well.
That's actually a very nice segue to the point I wanted to make, because I see Dr. Beth Lavis in the room and my colleague Dr. Andrew McMichael from History Department and Potter College Dean's Office. This is not just a veteran-friendly campus, it's an active duty-friendly campus. And my colleague, Dr. McMichael, made me aware for the first time that there were students in our online courses who were on active duty in Afghanistan. And he worked with this student all semester, and you can do everything that needs to be done for a course because of the great things that we do in distance learning. He was able to take final exams, all of the things on time with everybody else. It was truly amazing. So it's not just veterans, it's active duty personnel, and we can have those course experiences for people all over the world, even in a place where this was when the war in Afghanistan was, frankly, at its height.
Actually, we turned in the paper 3 days late because his unit was pinned down in a firefight. That was a valid excuse, actually.
Yeah.
Pinned down the firefight.
Sure.
The story is
sure.
So important.
Yeah.
And last semester, we had 50 active duty accounted for. This semester, we have 157. So our numbers are growing dramatically.
I just also want to mention about the Textbooks for Troops program. That is completely funded by gifts and donations that's not budgeted. And something Tanya said I wanted to just emphasize, those textbooks often make the difference as to whether or not a student will come or not. Because
yes.
Textbooks in a given semester might be $200, $400, and some of these folks simply do not have that. So those, and we're going to have an auction in December or maybe mention that, but we're going to have an auction in December to continue to raise money, because that is, again, an externally funded kind of a program.
This is Airman Tiffany Dinkler right here, and she is an Air Force, junior Air Force airman in Utah. And she called me, and I said, Tiffany, how did you find Western? And she said, I found you guys on the website. And I said, why did you choose Western? And she said, because of the free textbooks. So this is the story that we're hearing more and more in our office, so I'm just so proud to offer this program.
Would you please tell about the sisterhood they just...
Yes.
I think, and maybe Catherine, you might please step in on that.
I wanted to say two things. This wonderful small staff, there are three of them, came to us to say, we don't have really any funding. And so they have been out seeking money. We've been doing things to help them. They won an award from the sisterhood this year. They won the competition. So in addition to the dedication that you heard her talk about, they themselves, with really no resources, are out trying to scrape together pennies to be sure they can implement the program. And I want to applaud them because they've been very proactive. They're very innovative, and they're completely dedicated. And I think it's just inspiring to see what they've been able to accomplish. And the sisterhood recognized it, and we've got other things that we hope are going to bring more resources for them. But I think they've done a wonderful job of not just sitting there and saying we need it, but going out and seeking help in every way.
Thank you. You all are so kind, and it's so touching to know that we have so many caring people in our community that are caring about our active duty and our veterans, because it really is a tough job and they're out there every day in danger. So I from the bottom of my heart, I thank you so much for your time this morning. And if, do we have any other questions or comments?
But before you bring in Can Do, let me just make one comment, too. In an era where we seem to be experiencing some declining enrollment, these numbers are very enticing, to say the least. And where would our enrollment be without those extra 1,500 that have been generated in the last 3 years? So that's terrific as well.
We've been working very hard to make it even more. So, and I'm encouraging our online guys, you know, when I go to the National Guard units, I tell them, while you're on deployment, take a class, because that is something that keeps us grounded on deployments. I can remember being there and wanting something to keep my mind off of where I was at. So this is something that I encourage the parents. Have your son or daughter take the class while they're on deployment.
Well, I was just going to ask if veterans receive a priority registration. They do.
They do.
On the tier one or tier two?
Yeah, we implemented a...
What was the question?
So the question was, well, these active duty military receive priority registration privileges? The answer is yes, they do. So they can register. First priority is to graduating seniors to make sure they get the course they need to graduate. And then we have a thing called Tier 1, and military students, activity military students are in that class. They can register before the open registration period to make sure they get the classes they need.
Well, perhaps it's time to meet Can Do, and may I suggest when you go down to Fort Campbell and slip in there, maybe don't take Big Red with you.
Okay.
Slip in and slip out.
Be aggressive at Fort Campbell.
We can?
Oh,
well,
yeah.
Take him then, and take Can Do too.
Austin P. likes to say it's theirs, but there's nothing that says it
can
be ours.
Is the only therapy dog in a military. Oh, yep. Stretch? Come on, let's go. Let's say hi. Absolutely. He's a therapy dog, so he's a little different than a regular service dog because we encourage everybody to pet him because he just brings a little piece of joy to everybody's day. And this is kind of the reason that we got him, because we do have a lot of military students that are suffering from anxiety issues. And sometimes they just need to come in and they just say, Tanya, can I just talk to you for 5 minutes? Well, of course you can. But this is just another tool in our kit to help our military students. Come on, buddy. Let's go. Let's say hi to everybody. But Can Do is not even 2 years old yet. He weighs 94 pounds. He's been at the university for just about 2 weeks now. And when we were researching these dogs, he specializes in assisting autistic children also. So in the afternoon, come on, buddy. So in the afternoons, he goes to the Kelly Autism Program. And one of the autism programs told us that they've had their dog for 6 months. And one of their nonverbal autistic children has said her first words. She's a teenager. And her first word was dog.
Oh.
And her second word was Deuce, which is the name of their dog. So we are so excited about the possibilities that this dog can bring to our campus. And not only to our military student services. Come on, buddy. Oh, good boy. Now, that's his visit. That's his visit command. That's what he does. That's how he does it.
Bob, you can't be on television with that dog, too. This was a gift from Terry Scariot and John Kelly. Can Do trained at the Smoky Mountain Training Center in Knoxville, Tennessee for nearly 2 years. She is a cream English golden retriever. And as Tanya said, spends part of the day with our military students and veterans and part of the day with the Kelly Autism Program. Marty Bowman, who directs the Kelly Autism Program, takes Can Do home at night. And Can Do is specifically trained to bring calmness and tranquility and ease tensions. I'm not sure how you take a lab that's always love me, love me, love me, let me lick you. into what Can Do's special skill sets are, but it's pretty cool. So Can Do is now a member of our faculty and staff, is an employee, and is fed well to earn his keep. and he'll be part of our university family for a long time. And I think we're among the first dogs and first universities in America to have a dog as in our workforce as part of our educational enterprise.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you.
What about can do? I'll send this around if you'll circulate it around.
I don't see why we couldn't train the dogs over at the President's Mansion.
We got a lot of work to do on that.
More than 2 years.
They've had too many years of just the opposite training.
All right, we have one more informational item that our provost will tell us about the degree approval process. He showed me this graph a few weeks ago in his office, and I think we're not going to memorize it, but if you can give us a brief overview of how new programs become approved and accredited.
Well, thank you, Regent Bell. It's a tough act to follow, but I'll try. We bring several programs to this board for approval every year, and that's part of quite an elaborate process. I'd just like to briefly review for you so the board can kind of see its role in the process. Any new program or revised program, of course, starts within the department or school, and it's faculty-driven. Faculty identify a need for a program based on a variety of factors. Student demand, career opportunities for graduates, and so forth. And they propose, on a rather sort of lengthy form, a new program, which is then reviewed and passed on to the college committee here, if my thing's working, which is not, fair enough. Once it leaves the college, things get interesting, because in parallel, the program passes through an internal approval process involving several faculty units, including for undergraduate programs, something called the UCC, or Undergraduate Curriculum Committee. For graduate programs, the Graduate Council. We then make a recommendation to the University Senate. Once it's approved by the Senate, it is recommended to me. In parallel with that process, and to provide some kind of expediency to this process, which can take several months, even if everything goes according to plan, we send the program, after it leaves the college, to a 45-day review by the Council on Post-Secondary Education, the blue box. Yeah. So, for example, the programs that the board approved today in Arabic and in Chinese were sent to the CPE about 2 or 3 months ago to start an internal process of review by CPE. During that period, all other institutions in the Commonwealth are invited to comment. When another institution in the Commonwealth submits a program proposal, I am invited to comment. All the provosts can comment, and that's to address issues of potential duplication, possible collaboration, joint degree programs, collaborative degree programs, and so forth. So I get it when it leaves the college and send it in parallel through this. At the end of the 45-day review, we are invited to submit a full proposal to the CPE, and only after I have received that invitation from the CPE and a positive recommendation to the Senate do I bring it through the President to this board. So by the time you see a program for approval, it's already passed muster not only internally through the faculty approval process, but also externally through the Council on Post-Secondary Education. From that point on, the proposal essentially stands on its merits. And the full proposal that we then submit to the CPE includes a significant number of considerations. As I indicated, student demand, and it's very important that that's just not anecdotal. The CPE requires a pretty thorough analysis of student enrollment in similar programs at other institutions, and so forth. Career opportunities, employer demand for graduates from the program. Do we have a sufficient budget to operate the program? Do we have a sufficient staff, sufficient faculty? Do those faculty have adequate credentials to offer the program? Do we have sufficient space and possibly equipment to offer the program. And for example, in our doctor of physical therapy program, that was a very significant issue, requiring a great deal not only of office space, but also of laboratory space and some relatively expensive equipment. What are our admission policies to the program? What process will be used to assess student learning outcomes from that program and to monitor the progress of graduates after they earn their degrees? So all of that is prepared. Again, once we have an invitation from CPE to prepare that proposal, and once the Board of Regents has approved that, we move it on to the CPE. And so, for example, the degree programs that were just approved this morning in Arabic and Chinese will be considered by CPE at its meeting on November 7th. That's in Madisonville, Kentucky. Once it is approved by CPE, we can so-called implement the program, and that means we can advertise it, that it's a real program, we can admit students to the program, and it then enters our permanent academic inventory where it undergoes a periodic 6-year review, and all the things I mentioned earlier are reviewed every 6 years. We do that internally anyway, and over the last couple of years we've been working with the CPE to synchronize their external review process with our internal review process. So when we conduct our review of approximately 1/6 of our programs every year, we prepare essentially a summary sheet and we submit that to the CPE at the same time. Some programs require a little bit of extra care and attention. If a program involves teacher certification, it passes through an internal unit called the Professional Education Council, chaired by Dean Sam Evans, and on to the Educational Professional Standards Board, a state agency which endorses that degree for the purposes of awarding teacher certification in a certain area. Certain degree programs, not all, but any degree program that constitutes what SACS would call a substantive change to our curriculum, any new doctoral degree is one, any program offered extensively online would be another, program offered at a new location might be another. We have to notify the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools. We do that at the beginning to give them a heads up that this is coming, and then we formally notify them at the end through submission of what is called a prospectus, and that goes into our determination of where we are with SACS. Currently, we are SACS Level 5, which means we are accredited to offer associates, baccalaureate, specialist, and doctoral degrees up to 3. When our 4th doctoral degree is approved, we will go to SACS Level 6, which is the highest level within that accreditation body. So again, just to summarize, I wanted to see that, you know, a lot of work goes in before and after this board is presented with a new program for approval, but we value immensely the contributions that the board provides to the process.
Thank you, Mr. Provost. And that does give everybody an overview. Nobody's going to be tested about it since it's only slightly less complex than the Krebs cycle. I'm thankful for that. With that, Mr. Chairman, that concludes the business of the Academic Committee.
Thank you, Dr. Pagel. I have a report of the